Greetings to the crew. This is your nav speaking once again from the mail room. It's July 28th, 2012, and I'm making another recording in the attempt to catch up with crew mail. Proceeding in this recording, as I did previously, I'm jumping back to the beginning of April, and I'm coming forward through the month of April, picking up those emails which are relevant and to which I feel I can respond adequately within the framework of an hour's talk. I want to say, by the way, that I expect after a few more of these mailroom reports to be totally current with my crew email, and I'd like to stay current. I do have, however, about over 150 emails at the JLL address, which I have yet to answer. So those of you who have written me on JLL and haven't heard back from me, I do intend to get to those emails as well. I'm making that a second priority. First, I want to take care of to respond to those of you who've written me at the Navigator. So jumping back to April 4th and coming forward, there's a long mail from Shelley. Long and vivid mail, and it touches on a number of points that are still relevant today. One is, Shelley reports that she did hear the sounds that were being heard around the world at the beginning of this year, and indeed more or less ongoing for several years now. And the way she describes it is like this. It was like a long, slow, resonating, booming sound, like the combination of a ship's foghorn, the creaking of wet, straining wood beams, and a deep, throaty call, almost like a great animal announcing her whereabouts to the pack. There was that deliciously long pause of anticipation in between each sound when you're not sure you're going to hear it again. There were maybe only four or five of them before they stopped. End quote. So I think it's remarkable, whatever one concludes ultimately about those sounds, how closely they resembled nautical sounds, even if they were faked. Even the fake ones resembled nautical sounds. Now, why would the faked sounds alleged to be coming from the earth or the sky resemble, as Shelley says, a ship's foghorn, and the wet creaking of wet, straining wood beams? I also compared those sounds to the sounds of the plates of an ocean liner warping as it moves through heavy seas. At this point in the navigation process, it appears as we've more or less put that phenomenon behind us, it's not evident on the alternative media anymore. Rather, we've had our attention drawn to the strange sounds that began in June and into July, that were registered on that piece of equipment called the induction magnetometer. So whatever one makes of those sounds we were hearing, I think it's remarkable that they sounded like what the experiment said was happening. At that moment of the experiment last year, when the mothership undertook the first moments of self-navigation and self-propulsion, when she was pulled into position by the Jupiter tug, when the Earth moved through the apsides of Jupiter, it passed the face of Cetus, and according to the mythography of this experiment, when the Earth began to actually free herself from the capture of the planetary system and move independently through interstellar space, these sounds occurred, almost as if they were an hallucinatory effect, as it were. Could they have been an hallucinatory effect in the collective consciousness of humanity that actually broke through into audible hallucinations. You know, human beings under stress and in traumatic situations will outwardly and sensorially manifest their inner hallucinations. This is possible that those sounds could have been auditory hallucinations of the human species, based on an unconscious detection of what we in the Gaia navigation experience were consciously monitoring. So just consider how wonderful is that. Shelley goes on to mention two issues that have played a really vital role and prominent role in our experiences in this on this experiment over the last 9 months. An incredible surge of libido rendered me cross-eyed with no freaking outlet. Knowing something important was happening to me, I didn't know what. It was pleasant in a very intense kind of way, a bit too intense. I must admit that there was a tiny thought of maybe I'm finally losing my marbles, but just a tiny one, and I instinctively knew I wasn't. Then I listened to the latest talks and understood it was me feeling the shock of her remembering. End quote. Well, you'll all recall that I put out the signal in the spring that sentient creatures and principally human animals were going to feel a tremendous spiking and augmentation of libido and sexual and erotic craving due to the awakening of the planetary mother animal. So here is Shelley giving us some vivid testimony on that. She goes on to write, quote, "The mantis is an interesting glitch in the story. Holy crap. I feel so bad for the dilemma Gaia Sophia is in. She can't free the mantis without destroying her experiment, at least not at first glance. How can she shrink it so it can get out, up and out through the existing fissures?" These comments, I'm sure, are outdated now, as I haven't listened yet to CN16. And the following crew notes. End quote. Well, not at all outdated, Shelley, not at all. We're all hanging on the edge of our seats wondering how the Aeon Sophia is going to liberate Mantis. This is a huge problem, and it is usually connected with the wave of terrorism that engulfs this planet. As I've said, you can incorporate the Mantis episode into your version of the Sophia vision story or not. It's optional. If you don't buy it, you don't have to buy it. But those of us who do incorporate the Mantis episode are looking very closely at how the Mantis could be freed, and so this is an ongoing concern. Finally, she refers to the fact that she would love to do the carnal embrace ritual, but as many others of you have indicated, she simply doesn't have anyone, male or female, to do it with. Finally, she adds that, quote, "I am very, very, very interested in right action," end quote. And she goes on to describe some experiences she had with a low-life liar, swindler, creep, psychopath, jerk-off, two-faced piece of shit scumbag. Unfortunately, Shelley is one of those people who has seen her life and resources directly impacted by one of these psychopaths, but she is less and less the exception. We are all in the target range of these psychopaths, and we have much to learn from people like her who have had firsthand encounters with these monstrous specimens. Is a brief message from Marcus, who reports viewing the movement of Venus toward the Pleiades from a village in Tiger Leping Gorge next to Tibet in the Himalayas. So we have some crew members who are ranging around the planet to some very exotic places. Next, a message from Miguel concerning a reference to my dream of the Green Man. He says, quote, "I was riveted listening to your Green Man dream. It was as if I was there. For some reason, it, together with the subject of your talk on divine alchemy, reminded me of a dream I had back in August 2002. When I think of the professor in the dream, I sense Goethe. And when I think of the growing plant, I sense your description of the process of reticulation, metabolism, and articulation, and our intimate connection to them in our origins." End quote. Yes, I even recall now, I had completely forgotten that I spoke about this dream that I had around 16 or 17, the dream of the green man. And that I later found an image of that green man in a book on Gaia theory. I've suggested, as you know, some recommended studies for this summer of 2012, and among them being Wilhelm Reich, read Ether, God, and Devil, Cosmic Superimposition. You might start there, actually, and work backwards. That was one of his last books. Read and study and learn whatever you can about Anton Mesmer, Animal Magnetism. This is the key to the future. Animal magnetism is the secret of the libido of the goddess, something that I haven't spoken of to this point. And finally, of course, Goethe and Goethean morphology and Goethe's science is really the prelude to Gaian science and Gaian biophysics. I have a message from crew member Mary G, touching on the subject of chaos theory and the principle or law of conduction. She quotes something I wrote or said, namely, "New Agers have fallen in droves under the false spell of the law of attraction, but obviously attraction is just one pole of the world power, the other being repulsion. Attraction alone cannot comprise a law. Conduction includes both attraction and repulsion. This is the complete law for achieving dynamic alignment with the desideristic or wish-granting powers of the Shakti cluster." End quote. As I mentioned before, the secrets of the law of conduction, which includes both attraction and repulsion, is a Dakini teaching exclusive to Idris, although certain aspects of that teaching are shared with Chinnamasta, the self-beheading Mahavidya. Mary G. goes on to say, quote, "I am nurtured by, with great gratification, by a mention of the activation of the central channel and the very tangible clinical fact of a concurrent great healing proceeding rapidly in my own core, both the GI tract and the brainstem." So it goes. She also says that just keep the story intact and the details that you need to learn will adhere to your mind. That's some advice I gave. She says that seems to be playing out palpably in her life. I'm always really happy when I hear crew members say this, that because it proves that what I'm saying is true. And, it, you know, it legitimates me, as it were, as if I needed to be legitimated. But I love this confirmation when it comes in this way. And we are all in the same boat, to use the nautical metaphor. We are all in the same story. The boat is the story. The story is what guides. Just like the term of Gaia Awakening is the guru and the teacher. There is no human, physical, single physical master or teacher at the end of Kali Yuga. We are all students of the Dharma of Gaia Awakening, adepts and acolytes of that fantastic wisdom teaching. And within that teaching, the vision story of the Aeon Sophia is what guides us and actually frames our lives in a transpersonal way. So this is one of the most wonderful things that we share in the GNE. The transpersonal perspective on life provided by that story is one of the fabulous advantages and benefits of this practice. And I always love to be reminded of that and to hear your testimonials to that truth. Next message from Sibyl, a.k.a. Balsam. I actually had some occasion to talk with Sibyl after this mail. We talked on Skype concerning the chemtrail phenomenon. She initially wrote, she's a crew member. She initially wrote, though, in response to a remark I had made, which many of you picked up on. She says, quote, I asked you to supply your evidence for the idea I thought you held that the phenomena doesn't exist. I think that in doing so, I took a very open-minded and dialogue-oriented approach. I was basically ready and willing to hear potential evidence that something I apparently see almost every day may not exist, end quote. Well, of course, we cleared up that misunderstanding in subsequent emails and in our conversations. And I assured Sibyl that I certainly do not deny that some chemtrailing and some geoengineering experiments do exist, nor do I deny the phenomenon to which she has been witness, which is the Morgellons, so-called Morgellons disease. But what I do question is the supposition that there is a massive agenda of global geoengineering being implemented every day all around the world. And this is an important point. The question of chemtrails keeps coming up in the context of the GNE. It's an important point because if we credit certain things in this, that are seen in the sky, certain phenomena and conditions of the atmosphere to geoengineering, and we're mistaken, then that is the equivalent to blinding ourselves to what the planetary animal mother herself could be doing by way of modifications of the atmosphere. An extremely important issue here. Next up, a brief email from Jason. He refers to the 19th century scientists Poincaré and Lorentz, who he says are actually the two chief sources that nerd king Al Einstein ripped off for his work. He provides an interesting link to an article in the Occidental Observer describing how Einstein ruined physics. I couldn't agree more. There are some really good YouTube clips, by the way, you could watch if you wish to educate yourself about the fallacies and absurdities in Einsteinian theory, including both special and general relativity. You know, as someone who dedicated for a good many years of my life, I would say from the age of 16 through to about 26, I would say for 10 solid years, I beat my head against the wall trying to make sense of special and general relativity. And the story of how I was liberated from that is a little anecdote I might be able to tell sometime. It came from reading a book called Einstein's Theory, Considered from the Viewpoint of Epistemology. This is a book or study written by Ernst Cassirer. And I read a lot of Ernst Cassirer when I was young. He was sort of one of the people who led me into the study of comparative mythology. And Einstein's theory of relativity, considered from the epistemological point of view, finally broke me out of the trance of absurdity of Einsteinian science. And that was a really big breakthrough for me. Jason points out that Einstein hated the idea of ether and pledged his life to destroy it. And this is very significant because we know that the idea of ether was much disputed in the 19th century and eventually eliminated from the scientific canon of conventional principles. But today, the idea of ether is returning through plasma cosmology and the electric universe. I don't particularly like the word ether. The Sanskrit equivalent Sanskrit word would be akasha. But as you know, the 3 years of setting the initial conditions of correction are also 3 years critical to the foundations of a true science, a true Gaian cosmology, a true Gaian physics and biophysics. And central to this Gaian science that can emerge in this three-year period is the concept of the Akasha or ether. And so far, no one that I know of has really presented a clear and consistent formulation of that concept, nor has anyone indicated how it can be verified and tested through direct personal experience without instruments. The question arises, of course, well, what is the relationship between ether, Akasha, and the organic light? That's a very good question. I would not say that they are the same. The organic light is not what was called ether or Akasha. It is rather a feature that belongs to another aspect of cosmic physics. But I don't know that much about it right now, and I can't talk about it in a way that would be elucidating, so it's a subject that I'm keeping on hold. What I do suggest is that you read Ether, God, and Devil, Cosmic Superimposition, and I suggest that you allow these concepts to float in your mind, rather like a selection of fruits floating in a fruit bowl filled with punch. So you've got some slices of tangerine, you maybe have some slices of melon, and some slices of orange, floating around in the wonderful, tasty punch of Gaian physics. And every once in a while, you sip the punch and you taste the flavors of these different fruits, which are organic light, ether, Akasha, orgone. These are the fruits. So just let them float around. And I am certain that if we put our minds and our attention to it, much will be revealed. And much will come to be defined in a helpful way in the near future. Next comes a note from Henriette in Denmark, raising a question. You mentioned that Sophia is recalibrating. Is she already recalibrating the overdoses of paranoia and cognitive latitude? Good question, Henriette. You can see she follows the instructions very closely. Another thing, quote, and this is from Henriette, is Sophia lucid dreaming all the time now, or is it so that between the perigees and apogees she is just dreaming, upholding the lives of all life here, like she did before she woke up in this nightmare? It is also exciting in sensitivity, Henriette. Well, these are really good questions, and they're just ongoing questions we all live with. Yes, I would say that she, and possibly also Telete, at this very moment, as I speak, are putting heads together and looking very closely at the high dosage of paranoia that they calibrated into the endowment of the Anthropos. Also, the question of cognitive latitude. Because if we didn't have so much cognitive latitude, we wouldn't be frightened by fictional and fraudulent threats. See, one of the great problems on this earth is, of course, this whole fraudulent theatrical agenda of the war on terror. To a great extent, it is a massive act of make-believe. People really get killed in this act of make-believe, but it is fundamentally an act of make-believe. It's as if there was a movie about, the American Revolution, say. And in the course of the movie, there were some battle scenes. Now, the movie is an act of pretending. And in these battle scenes, there would be extras fighting each other, shooting each other with rifles. But suppose that they were really killing each other in the act of pretending, of making the film. Suppose the extras in the film really died. This is really the situation in the world today, if you can get your mind around that. Where the biggest threat to the experiment is the combination of make-believe and biophobia, or fear of what is alive. Fear of what is alive is the root of terrorism. those human beings who are involved in spreading terrorism upon this planet are afraid of what is alive. That is what is motivating them. It's not a political or religious agenda, although they use these agendas, although they would probably tell you, if you interrogated them, that these agendas of religious salvationism, or these agendas of the technocratic elite, the agenda of transhumanism and eugenic selection, they would tell you, speaking out of their conscious mind, repeating the excuses that they make to themselves in their minds, they would tell you that these agendas are the basis of their motivations, but that is not the case. The basis of the motivation of those who inflict terror upon the vast majority of humanity who does not wish to live in terror is the fear of life itself. The fear of life itself puts terror in the souls of those who then propagate terror on others. This is the fundamental proposition seen in the perspective of this experiment. And of course, the way that the human animal deals with that depends upon our endowment, because we can only respond to our experiment based upon our capacities. And our capacities are predetermined by the endowment. Cognitive latitude is a really big problem. Remember, it's Thelete that gave us cognitive latitude. Cognitive latitude means that we can imagine many things that allow us to move outside of a strict instinctual program of behavior. So human beings can invent many things that beavers cannot invent because they have cognitive latitude, human animals, I should say. But the throwback of cognitive latitude is very, very serious, because it means that whereas beavers building a dam will panic when there is a clear and present danger to their lives and to their activities, human animals will panic when there is a supposed danger, when there is an imagined danger, when there is a fraudulent menace, and we are unable to distinguish between that which is a real threat to life and that which is a make-believe threat. And that is due to our cognitive latitude. And this is an extremely serious problem. And you can bet that the Aeon Sophia and her pleromic colleagues are looking at this very closely in the summer of 2012. Next is a message from crew member Keith. I found this message extremely moving, so I'd like to read his account to you. He says, this is in the context of the carnal embrace of the Anthropos. Keith says, quote, "Once again in my favorite Irish pub, I have a friend there who I see all the time. Her name is Sarah. Many years ago, she was a victim of a vicious rape, beating, and disfigurement. She almost died. The doctors were able to mend her, and she lives a normal life. She is a lesbian. Sarah and I often engage in long, tender hugs in public. I feel it is healing for her as well as for myself. I feel it is building a trust and a closeness with the masculine for her that could not be accomplished via conventional means. I want nothing from her. She wants nothing from me. It is a pure exchange of physical affection. This past Saturday, she was sitting on a bar stool next to me and asked me a question. I honestly don't remember the question. As to what was to follow caught me off guard and was a bit disconcerting. My reply to her was, 'The human race is going to make it.' The answer was spontaneous and was immediately followed by a huge surge of emotions. I burst into a torrent of tears. I could not have stopped it if I wanted to. When Mother Earth began dealing with me, one of the things she made clear was that a cleansing of the emotions was imperative. Your dream of the green man with a blossom in his chest jumped out right away as I recalled my own experience. The sensation to follow was that of a bubble of illuminating energy that surrounded both me and Sarah. She is not metaphysically inclined, but I saw in her eyes a sense of realization of who I was, which seemed to elevate her on an esoteric level. Following that event, my intuition seemed to have experienced a noticeable sharpening. There is less haze in the exchange with it after that day. It would seem that the articulation which I experienced did not affect my physical senses, but my sixth sense, my intuition. And the blossom of corrective emotion, presumably due to PT, struck me as a good analogy of the embodiment of the green man, end quote. I find this to be a moving account of what happens to people who really allow themselves to feel the intensity of emotions that one can feel in this process. And I love this phrase, the blossom of corrective emotion. Another long and lively message from Dame Miriam. Here she's writing in the context of the Swan Deva shift of the spring, when there were actually double Swan Deva shifts, which was extraordinary, and relating her affinity with the Seven Sisters. She writes, quote, "Yes, I do hear you and feel the pull of the origins of the arboreal women, although I do not have those specific memories yet. I am Hetaira. We can all now fully awaken to this and begin to intend and assist Sophia in her correction as sisters in the Pleiadian chamber. The dreaminess and even sadness and poignancy I have felt today now makes sense, and I am energized within the second attention. The expansiveness of the Swan Deva has reached me now that things have calmed down." End quote. Once again, clear evidence of how some of you crew members are following the Dakini shifts and learning to attune, not necessarily to the precise Dakini instruction, which is a subliminal syntax of a fleeting, rapid and fleeting nature, but certainly to the moods and themes of the Dakinis and Mahavidyas, and that's where it all starts. Here's a note from Mike entitled Mudras and Articulation. He writes, quote, "The navigator is spot on. Spontaneous mudras have found their way into my syntax. Mine is that of a gourd. Sitting half-cross-legged, my right hand sits palm up in front of my dantian point, while my left palm vertical thumb toward the heart is placed in front of the heart, making a gourd. I imagine the gourd being filled with a raw, tantric, erotic, insanely intense energy, and my body floods with this. The flowering of the human, or articulation, might just be the capacity to live off this pure energy, completely reanimating the senses. I've also been drawn toward the many breatharian interviews on the net. I envision a pure energy warrior defending her grace, honor, and beauty." End quote. Thank you, Mike. And to those others of you who are experiencing spontaneous mudras, play with them. See if they persist. See what they show you. And learn from the articulations of your own body what the energy of your body wants to do. Mar in Mallorca also tells me that she's experiencing mantras, or mudras rather, hand positions that are exactly like those that I describe, but they come to her spontaneously. Here's a message from Susanna about the film The Hunger Games. It gets into some Kalika themes because the film portrays hunting down and killing people for sport. So I'm not going to go there, but I will quote one thing that Susanna says regarding her participation in Planetary Tantra. Quote, "I am very happy about all of it, and your reminder is good that intuition is the key and that the practice is intuitive rather than intellectual," end quote. Thank you, Susanna, for noting that and pointing that out. Next, here's Miguel reporting a Swan Deva moment on April 10th. Actually, he was driving home after listening to the Navigator Chaos Talk, or while listening to it. crossed an old bridge over the River Wye. I may have gone over that bridge myself more than once. I know that area of between England and Wales quite well. And two beautiful swans flew up from the river and flew over him. It's amazing, these bird omens that keep happening, frequently reported by crew members. Here's a message from Steve, reflecting on the question of whether the globalist psychopaths are close to their end game. Are they going to provoke a world war by the flagrant attacks on Syria, which are, you know, I wouldn't even call them loosely veiled anymore. It's quite obvious what's being done in that country, what's being done to that country. To me personally, it's extremely poignant to hear anything about what's happening in Syria or to listen to Syrian Girl, for instance, if you know who that is. I can barely do that. Syria and Damascus are places that were in the very heartland of the ancient Gnostic mysteries. Syria could be called the heartland, and Lebanon was the paradise of those Gnostic mystery schools. So the horror we see perpetrated there today, the USA, UN, Zionist assault on Syria under the phony pretext of protecting Syrian people from their own leader, Assad, is a horror, great horror to behold, and it's pushing the Russians and the Chinese into a very aggressive posture. So what's going to happen? I don't know. It would, of course, be hugely to the advantage of the globalist psychopaths, wear the mask of Zionism most prominently, to provoke a global conflict by what they're doing in Syria. Will they succeed? It's anybody's guess. Next comes a mail from Onome. Hope I'm pronouncing the name right. Onomi or Onome. With some fascinating references to comparative mythology. She says, are you aware of the Fogvangr in Norse mythology? We all know that the battle brave were picked by the Valkyries to go hang out in Valhalla, but that's only half the story. The other half were picked by Freya to go to Fogvangr, which literally translates as the field of the host. One theory about this is the difference between Odin's hall and Freya's meadows has to do with what sort of warrior vow you took to begin with. Fantastic. This is really fascinating, and it's a message that requires an extended and elucidated response, which I can't obviously give in the context of the mailroom. Quote another paragraph here. She says, quote, concerning Odin and Freya, of course, Odin is the male shamanic warrior god in Scandinavian mythology. Freya is the female warrior counterpart. Concerning Odin and Freya, there had been questions amongst the crew about how one knows if they are part of Kali's band. I'm coming to the conclusion that Mahavidyas sort out battle duty. I've been going through a period of personal excavation, looking through my writings in the past decades, and discovered that Sophia has been nesting Easter eggs in my path all along. There's always been a feature of right action running through my writing, though not in a direct or frontal Kalika fashion, but more in a collapsing the system way. I'm inclined to think I might belong to the espionage/sabotage gradient of the Sorcerer's Party. End quote. Well, of course, what Onami is bringing up here is something that keeps coming up again and again. Although I try to be delicate, cautious, and discreet about it. And that is the interface between the Gaia Navigation Experiment and the triple calling of the Kali Band, which is love, war, and magic. So, as I've said, and as you know, there is a firewall. I don't talk in any lurid or exact detail about certain Kallika practices within the frame of this experiment. However, I'm beginning to wonder, as perhaps some of you are as well, if I can maintain this firewall through the entirety of our experiment until March 2014. Depends what the planetary animal mother herself does in correction, doesn't it? Depends on what she does. I've already said she asked for proof of love. Now, if you've been contemplating that question, it's going to take you right into the Kallika warrior path. At the same time, I don't want to jump the gun here. There is nothing on this earth that I consider more carefully than the approach to this topic. You know, I could do things right now, believe me. Ha! I'm sure you wonder. I could do things right now. I could put a 35-minute clip on the internet that would send out a momentous Kallika signal across the planet. But if I did it now under the current circumstances of this moment today, I would be gone in 12 hours. And I'm not going to play it that way. So I stand at the edge, always. I stand at the edge, the razor edge. I dance on the razor edge of this question. And some of you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment are not inclined to go there. That's fine. Don't worry. Be comfortable. Stay on board. Some others of you, like Onome writing here, are very inclined to go there. As a matter of fact, she's saying she's already been there already in her life for a good part of her life. And I'm sure others of you would say the same thing. So bear with me, be patient, don't lose patience, as perhaps certain people have recently dropped me from their agenda, perhaps because they thought that I wasn't delivering the goods on the Kallika warrior proposition. Well, we'll see about that. Next is a brief message from George. I am getting down to the end of April here. This is great. A brief message from George referring to Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke as Gnostic writers. George says, "Hi, Nav. Interview with Jay Widener. He brings in Gnostic teaching of archons taking over man. Attributes Kubrick and Arthur Clarke as writing from a Gnostic understanding," end quote. Okay, well, that's true. As you know, Jay Widener is a colleague of mine. I consider him as a friend, very warm, decent, loving, and enjoyable person who did the DVD on the Dawn of Planetary Tantra. And, of course, Jay talks a lot about the archons and sometimes cites me. He doesn't handle the archon factor of our planetary narrative in just the way that I do. And he doesn't tend to talk about the Sophianic aspect at all, except in some allusions to the feminine, but not really in depth. What I would say about Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke is that they certainly were artists operating from a Gnostic understanding. They had a Gnostic understanding, and they had a Dia-Gnostic view of the archontic intrusion upon humanity. Absolutely. I mean, look at HAL in 2001. The computer is called HAL, archonic entity who tries to take over the Jupiter mission is called HAL. And as I've noted, H-A-L is a Coptic word for deceit or simulation as practiced by the archons. HAL is the highest signature of the archons. So there's a wealth of Gnostic elements in Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, but there is a lack of Sophianic elements. So make that distinction. Next comes a note from Julie F. White killer whale. First one ever filmed in the wild, and she gives a link to a story of a white killer whale. And she says the Inuit call them the wolves of the sea. So we've got white owls, white whales, white buffaloes, all these white animals appearing, the white lions being the first epiphany. And I urge you all to read Linda Tucker's book, The Mystery of the White Lions, which features Kwedo Mutwa, by the way. It's a tremendous part of the epiphany of the animal powers of the planetary animal mother. Next comes a report from Dame Miriam, who is obviously a prodigious contributor to the Crew Mail, writing about the witnessing of the Dakini shift at the end of April. Quote, I felt the new Dakini shift on the new moon. The presence of these Dakinis has been growing, and there was a frantic feeling until last night as the energy settled for me. A beautiful night sky last night allowed me to see the new crescent moon, and I felt those powerful Dakinis even more. Today I feel the strength of the wrathful green Tara and the beauty of Bhudevi. Like this huge, strong hand opening to me to usher me along very gently to wherever I want to go. Generous, gracious, elegant. End quote. Well, the Dakinis are nothing if not that. Generous, gracious, and elegant. As I'm reading this mail, it occurs to me that those of you in the crew who are attuning to the Dakini shifts are actually honing your telepathic abilities for the experiment now underway, namely, to see if we can establish a generic routing system through Channel 16. I don't know yet how we're going to do that. Now, the next occultation of Jupiter occurs on August the 11th, about 2 weeks from now. So I'm going to be sure to get out some suggestions to you as to how we might set up that experiment. I think we would be do well to take our time and to use the month of August and possibly also the occultation of September to set up the experiment very, very carefully so that then in October, November, and December, in the following four occultations in those 3 months, we can really test Channel 16. One of the wonders, one of the thrilling discoveries, I may say, of Planetary Tantra is that we flow together into this group telepathy. All of you located all around the world, in South Africa, New Zealand, in the Ukraine, in Wales, in Canada, in Hawaii, all of you can observe the crescent moon. Or if you cannot actually see the crescent moon due to atmospheric conditions, you can observe the moment of its appearance. It's equally valuable to be present for the moment of its appearance as well as for the appearance itself. And this is one of the ways, one of the primary way actually, that we attune our first attention to a telepathic frequency, as it were. And so the practice of observing the lunar shifts, as demonstrated by this crew member, has already been preparing some of you for the excitement to come as we discover what to do with Channel 16. Finally, we come to an email at the end of May, which was sent to me by Catherine in Texas. Now, this is one of the really dangerous Kalika bitches wandering around out there across the surface of the world. And she's sent me a link, which I'm going to include with this posting in the mailroom, mailroom 05. It contains, interestingly, some Spanish singing and guitar. The well-known song La Malagueña. La Malagueña means the girl from Malaga, which is not too far from where I live in Spain, as you know. But it's a YouTube clip, and the visual content of the clip has nothing to do with Spain and Andalusia, curiously. But it has to do with sharks. And it's a most amazing and beautifully filmed clip. I forward it on to you with my comment. This clip shows what you cannot do with human predators. Even sharks are less dangerous than bankers. not to mention so-called politicians, such as Hillary Clinton, who is a murderous and deceitful psychopath. So I include that link to that YouTube clip. And finally, I've caught up to the mail up to June 19th. So coming forward, I have mail in the Navigator's mailbag from June 19th, not too long ago. And I'm going to clear this up as quickly as I can going forward. And then I'm going to drop back in the next two mailroom sessions, drop back over past email. Now, some of this past email preceding the 1st of April 2012, I may have already answered. I may have responded to it in written form. I can't really remember. But I'm going to rake through and select some of the more relevant pieces of mail from the past, and in that way wind up this exercise in the mailroom. From that point on, any postings I make in the mailroom will concern current mail. Anyway, that's the plan, Stan. And I guess it's as good as plans can be. Given that I have about 10 more minutes in the usual time frame of this mailroom session, I will cover some current mail. Starting out with what? Well, here's a message from Kevin, reporting from the Olympic National Park. I guess that would be Washington State. Kevin describes an experience he had on the 8th of August, 2008, 8th, 9th of August, a most significant date. The anniversary, by the way, is coming up soon. He describes having an experience of pure sound or pure sound energy that encircled him while he was asleep. He says, somewhere in my navel area, this vibration did a slow elliptical circle around me. I was laying on my left side, and it worked its way around me, around my bottom and up my back. The closer it got to my head, the louder it became, to the point where I was paralyzed with fright, but yet in awe of the beauty of its sound. You are probably wondering, well, what did the sound sound like? The closest I can describe is a didgeridoo. Am I pronouncing that correctly? End quote. Well, I have said before that the Aeon Sophia sent out a signal in the summer of August 2008, and I'm sure that a number of people captured this signal in different ways. You might recall that I said I'd been talking recently with Max Egan, who does a radio show from Australia. He said that during this exact moment of 2008, he received some kind of massive download from what appeared to be a feminine source, a feminine energy. I've also had close discussions with Catherine from France. This is a Dakini of high accomplishment who gave me a startling account of experiences that unfolded in the summer of 2008, very, very close parallel to my own. At that time, we did not know of each other's existence, and she didn't discover planetary tantra until some years later. So Kevin's account is but another proof of what I assert, that the signal was there and that a number of human animals received it in different ways. In the second part of his letter, he talks about an encounter he had with an opossum and gives some interesting information about that creature. Quote, the opossum is a nocturnal animal. It is the only marsupial in the North American continent. Many opossums have 13 nipples. The number is very symbolic. The opossum is widely known for its defensive ability of playing dead and with its self-induced state of shock. The pulse becomes minimal. The heartbeat slows. a musk scent of death is released, and for all appearances it will seem dead. The opossum can enter and leave this state pretty much at will. End quote. And he ends with a question. What is your take on what Gaia Sophia teaches through certain animals, such as the opossum? Well, I think we're at the point of learning very, very deeply and profoundly, very radically and rapidly, just what Gaia Sophia teaches us through the behavior of other animals. After all, bear in mind, she is now undergoing Pleromic Relay. This means that the Pleromic Aeons are, in effect, restoring this experiment to the condition in which it would have been in had she been able to accomplish it through the Pleiadian spindling in the beginning. Had she been able to use narrative spooling via the Pleiades, she would have set this experiment up in such a way that the human animal has an optimal learning opportunity regarding its environment. Now that Pleromic Relay is underway, it could be said that we, those of us who are paying attention, are due to see how that opportunity is restored in its full depth and in its full scope. So if this is true, and if I'm getting anywhere near the truth here, I would expect these animal revelations, both large and small, these epiphanies of the animal power of the Divine Sophia, I would expect them to continue and multiply and amplify. Next comes a long message from Ken, who is in West Virginia. He's providing his location. I'm putting all these locations into one file, and eventually they'll be sorted and sent out in some manner so that those of you who are near each other can get in touch with each other physically if you choose to do so. Ken's email covers a range of topics, too long for me to reply to at any length. He thinks the Channel 16 experiment is tremendous. I feel this is really what will expand for all of us, as much as I'm sure we've had this ability all along, especially the Nahuals of the past. As we are all connected through the earth to Sophia, we are all connected to one another through her. Outstanding. End quote. He talks honestly and in a completely vulnerable manner about his loneliness, about the reignition of his desire recently, which has nearly driven him crazy. Many of you can relate to that. He says, quote, I feel like I'm 16 years old again, looking for every woman around me, but not having the guts to do anything about it. End quote. Well, most of us don't know how to act on this desire, but the desire is a spark that arises from the animal magnetism of the earth, and to carry that spark is the point. How and when and where and with whom we can share and exchange the spark remains to be seen. Ken also relates to me his experience with Bhairavi and how she has spiked his transpersonal rage, which has given him some distraction from loneliness and grieving. He had a deep personal loss recently. Might be noted that in the Bhairavi shift, terrible and catastrophic things can happen, or terrible experiences of loss and abandonment can come up from inside. They can happen externally or internally. Ken says that his experience with Bhairavi has pointed him into the study of Spartacus and the Third Servile War and led him to understand the intolerable condition of enslavement into which humanity has been thrown by the Archons. He then goes on to reflect about Sophia's adulteration. These are interesting notes. I can't comment on them at length, as I said. But bear in mind, all of you who write me, that I do read all the mail, and I do reflect on it when you contribute something of your thought, your insight, your intuition. And I value it all. Next, a message from Margel, who had just acquired Quest for the Zodiac. He's finding that the book really liberates him in his understanding of his place in the cosmos. And as I've said before, I look forward to setting up some kind of team or group or task force centered on Starbase. That would be a task for some members of the crew who are attracted to this new form of astrology, the astrology of the future, and the future of astrology, if I may say so. So we'll see how that takes shape in the remaining months of this year. Here's a brief but intriguing mail from Kath in Texas. She says, suspicious observers pointed out this morning that there are no CFCs to speak of in the Southern Hemisphere. So why the ozone problem since the 70s? Maybe Mantis working her way out because Hydra is in the South Pole sky, right? Really good point here. Really interesting to relate the phenomenon of the ozone hole in the Southern Hemisphere with Mantis. That is a remarkable feat of Gaian navigation. That is a remarkable connection of observation and imagination. Now, it is true that we've been hearing about the ozone hole in the Southern Hemisphere since the 70s, and maybe scientists have an explanation of why there should be an ozone hole caused by CFCs in that particular locale and not in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm sure they probably do. But from the imaginative perspective of this experiment, I think Kath's question is very relevant. Mantis wants to go to the large Magellanic Cloud, not to the constellation of Hydra. The constellation of Hydra is in the north, and I'm in the process of working up a sketch of that, which would put it into the form of a mantis. Of course, the mantis would be pictured in the northern sky and in the scenario of the northern constellations. Does not necessarily mean that the mantis has to be pictured in the southern sky. Its destination, however, is deep in the southern sky. Next comes a recent message from Anna, who is an artist and sculptor in South Africa. She originally contacted me quite a few years ago, so I've known Anna and been Anna Katarina and been communicating with her since before the Gaia Navigation Experiment. She contacted me about Coco de Mer, and that, not just about the concept of it, but of the actual object, the Coco de Mer seed. This is a seed of a plant that grows in the Seychelles, and it's the largest seed of any plant on Earth, and as you know, it has the form of the yoni, the form of a woman's pelvis with the yonic triangle. The Coco de Mer washes up on the beaches of India, where it is taken as a sacred object and enshrined in temples as a representation of the sexual and erotic powers of the divine Shakti. And Anna writes me saying, quote, I am contemplating some workshops on the Coco de Mer, whereby people can decorate a slip cast clay Coco de Mer and beautify the form according to their own color, and to have a personal experience with this form and what the form is saying to them. Unquote. And she asked the question, why are people still reacting to this feminine form? Anna has noted that people react very, very strongly to the form of Coco de Mer. I totally concur. That is why years ago, writing metahistory.org, I sought to break through into the area of tantric and kalika magic. Even at that time, I sought to break through into the area of the erotic on metahistory.org by writing about Coco de Mer. But I did so in the context of the Sophianic myth. I would say that one reason why, there are two reasons why people react so powerfully to the Coco de Mer. See for yourself. Go put it into a search engine and look up images of Coco de Mer and see how you respond. I've said that it's a kind of litmus test. You feel the shock of beauty. You feel a shock when you see the Coco de Mer seed, even when you see just a picture of it. There's actually someone in Gaosine I know actually owns one, and I was able to touch it, touch the physical seed. I would say that the shock that comes from this object of nature is twofold. In the first place, the shock of the divine feminine, the sacred feminine, is always vivid. You either feel it vividly and radically, or you don't feel it at all. And those human animals who are craving to reconnect with the planetary animal mother will always feel a shock from any form or shape or object or person, man or woman, who transmits the power of the divine terrestrial Shakti. And this seed does that. At the imaginative level, I've shown that this seed can be morphed into a kind of icon. I painted this icon. I think I did it with felt-tip pencils or colored pencils into the symbol of the trimorphic Protonoia, or the three-world system originally dreamed by the Aeon Sophia in the Pleroma. And so if you go look at the Coco de Mer icon on metahistory.org, which is also Kundry's tattoo, kind of standard tatouage for the GNA crew, you might say, you'll see that it contains the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon. And I think that imaginatively, even though people may not know what they're reaching for, something in human imagination responds to this form. You see, the Coco de Mer icon tells you that there is a divine seed of dreaming at the root of this world. The seed of this world is the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia. And that seed has the form of a threefold cosmos. So, both erotically and physically, as well as magically, the Coco de Mer conveys a powerful clue to our origins, and a powerful clue to the magical and erotic properties of this world in which we live. So, no doubt, this is a unique object in all of nature, the largest seed, largest plant seed in the world. Two more brief messages to round off this section. Here's a note from Linda, giving her location, which is in the Washington, D.C. area, and saying if there's any GNE people in this area would like to connect with me, that would be wonderful. So I'm putting this in the location file, along with the others, and eventually those addresses will be compiled and organized. For this session, I'm going to conclude with a link sent in by Marina, my friend in the fair land of Croatia, referring to the LTNF. This is a new scientific discovery. The lethal toxin neutralizing factor, LTNF. As she writes, another amazing, in quote, discovery rising to the surface, although the references to this date back to 1911. The link to a Yahoo blog called Sideshow refers to the fact that opossum protein makes an immune elixir that is effective against nearly all poisons. Now, this is amazing. I remember a few mails back, one of you asked the question, what can we learn? Well, one of the vital things to learn right now for the continuation of, for the success of our part in correction is to learn about toxins, the kind of toxins that we can brew up and release for use upon the globalist predators, and the way that we can use poisons to heal and even use certain substances for immunity from poison. So poison's in the air. Poison is going to be more and more in the air with the three hits of the perigee in the torso of the scorpion before it even hits the stinger. Haven't talked about that one yet. And I think it's amazing that the possum is a white animal, an epiphany of the planetary animal mother in that respect, and that it's also a mysterious animal who plays possum and who can pretend for certain purposes to be asleep in order to protect itself. I don't know if there's a lesson there, but there could be. I think there's a lot to learn from the possum. But I would close with a very, very famous quote. Some of you are far too young to know what I'm citing here. But there used to be a cartoon in the daily newspapers of the United States called Pogo. And the main character of this cartoon was a possum. And Pogo by Walt Kelly contained a great deal of satire and some very lacerating social comment at that time. And, of course, the most famous quote from the Pogo comic strip comes from the opossum himself when he says, "We have seen the enemy, and they are us." So I'll leave you with that note, and I'll be forging ahead here during my remaining days in Belgium to do Meerum 6 and 7 that ought to bring us up current with our correspondences. Thank you all, and safe passage.